you know, the major ways that the Catholic Church got involved.
Well, I think we ought to make some distinctions at the beginning, maybe clarify it. When you say church, if you mean the Bishop's Conference, that's one definition mm-hmm. of church. But there were a lot of other people locally and regionally involved. So it's always hard to distinguish them. The Conference of Bishops has a limited role. It's not the church. It's the spokesman for the Bishop's Conference. But before the conference got involved, you had Father Brizard as an individual who was very active. He's been in very poor health in recent years. I haven't seen him in a long time, but I think he's at Santa Clara. But he was involved for several years, you know, on his own, or perhaps representing the National Catholic Rural Life Conference. I don't know exactly what his status was then. And you had a number of priests in California on their own, one of whom died quite recently, Keith Kenny
mm-hmm.
from Sacramento, Father McCullough, Father McDonald. But they were on their own or representing their dioceses. They weren't representing the Bishop's Conference. So it's always hard to distinguish what you mean by the church. All that I can speak of from personal experience is the conference level, because that's where I was working. But I think in fairness to those people who were out there long before the Bishop's Conference got involved, they should be taken into account.
The two people I've met with so far have been... spent several hours with Father, with Leroy Chatfield, and that was very helpful.
Well, this would have
predated. Of course, he was involved from 65 on.
Yeah, well, he would have known them then.
And then I met with Gene Boyle, and that was very useful.
Well, the two priests who are still living, who were the first ones to contact Caesar, are McDonald and McCulloch. Okay. McCulloch is in Oakland, and McDonald is in San Francisco. I don't know exactly where they are now, but you can find them easily now.
How do you spell McCulloch? Is it M-C?
I guess O-U-G-H, McCulloch, I think. He's a pastor, I think, now in the Oakland Diocese. But they were both San Francisco priests before the Diocese of Oakland was started. And they were in some kind of farm worker ministry of their own in the Diocese of San Francisco.
Okay.
And they were the first two priests that I know of who had contact with Caesar, long before the movement got started, when he was still with...
CSO?
Yeah.
Okay.
When he was in San Jose. But they were there long before anybody else in the Catholic, insofar as Caesar himself is concerned.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they're both living. I forget the first name. Tom is McCullough's name. McDonald's name. I'd have to look it up before you go. But there, McDonald is a pastor in San Francisco, and McCullough is across the bay in Oakland.
Okay.
But you'll find references to them in most of the books about the movement.
Mm-hmm.
three or four that I've read
mm-hmm.
tell the story of their first relationship with Caesar.
Okay.
And I think, in a sense, they were the first ones to get Caesar thinking in terms of a union. He was still working with the Arius Foundation at that
mm-hmm.
time. He knew nothing about the trade union movement at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they began to supply him with reading material and so forth. Now, I cite that only because you have to make a distinction between the Bishop's Conference, which is a very limited role, and it has little, if any, control over people out in the field. It speaks only for the conference and not for the people out in
mm-hmm.
the field.
Some of the people I've talked to so far, like Father Boyle, talked about some of the early involvement of not only their own but other priests and lay people. But they, the impression that I was given, certainly by Father Boyle, was that the action of the Bishop's Conference really gave a legitimizing.
Oh yeah, to a certain extent that's true, but you have to, if you want to see the history of it,
mm-hmm.
though, you have to see where it came from.
Yes.
And the three men who are still living, who were the most active in the early days, before the conference got involved, were Brizard, who's I think in retirement now at Santa Clara because of health reasons,
mm-hmm.
McDonald and McCullough. They were in quite
okay.
early. but especially MacDonald McCullough.
Were they influential in the decision that the Bishops' Conference made to get directly?
No, they weren't involved in that.
No. Was that mainly
well, that
work
would
that
be
you
our,
did?
Our own staff, or mm-hmm. myself and others in the staff. Mm-hmm. But no, they weren't directly involved in that at all. But they prepared the way. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of people around. And furthermore, the conference itself, long before Caesar came along, had an interest in the farm labor problem.
Yes.
Over the years, my predecessor, Father McGowan, who was there for years, was extremely interested in the migratory labor, but there was no union then. Mm-hmm. So it was a progressive thing. Mm-hmm. Then when the union came along, when Caesar got started, then it came an issue. It became an issue at the conference as to how they would go about supporting it. I can roughly fill you in on that, but I can't fill you in on what individuals did long before the conference got involved.
Why don't you tell me about the conferences?
Well, what are you looking for? What do you?
What I'm looking for, I'm interested in the way the farm worker movement impacted the church. And, decisions that were made, involvements that developed because of what they were doing, and the ways that the church, through its various structures, like the conference, like the National Farm Worker Ministry, was able to facilitate the farm workers in having access to many, many money and people resources of the wider church.
Well, that's a relatively simple story. All that the conference did, basically, was to support the union and support the boycott eventually. It wasn't all that involved. Our department at the conference, the department in which I worked for many years, had a primary interest in the labor problem in general. They were interested in other things, but they had a continuing, long-standing interest in the labor problem, including the farm labor problem. But mainly the industrial problem, because there wasn't any farm workers union to speak of. So that it was a natural thing for the department, especially for myself, because I was working in that area all those years, to be interested in the farm labor problem. From a great distance, however, I knew nothing about it except from reading and occasional trips out there. When the union got on its feet, got started, then the situation was ripe for a decision by the conference. Here's this union, that's fledgling union, that's trying to get going. What do we do about it? I prepared these are, I must tell you, very rough remembrances. You'd have to go to the files to get the exact dates and everything. But I prepared a rough draft of a resolution, which I hoped that the bishops might consider. Speaking only about the specific action taken, because there were other things done. There were statements. I wrote lots of columns and that sort of thing. There were statements in support of farm labor. But when it came to supporting the union as such, mm-hmm. and the boycott as such, I proposed or prepared a memorandum or a resolution and floated it to see if we could get the bishops to consider it. I must pause for a moment and say they never before, and I think seldom in the future, will support a specific boycott. It's not that kind of an organization, because there are so many boycotts around. There are 8 or 10 now, and several of them have tried to get the bishops to support them, but that's not their normal policy, to support specific boycotts at a national level. But anyhow, I prepared this resolution. It was considered, and the California bishops, two or three of the California bishops who were present at the meeting, said, well, why don't we, first of all, before we support the boycott, before we announce the support of the boycott, see if there's anything that we can do to get this thing off dead center. The union had no contracts at that time, none at all. They were floundering. They had a small union, but they had nobody would deal with them. And the bishops said, well, these California bishops said, well, maybe we have to see whether there's anything we can do to mediate this thing, to get them going so that they get some contracts, is what they needed. I said then, in private conversations with the bishop, all right, but we can't stop with that. We have to start to implement that to see how we're going to find out what we do, if anything. As a result of that, they appointed this bishop's committee, a five-man committee, charged with the responsibility of going to California to see if there was anything that the bishops as a body could do through this committee to break the ice, to get some of the employers at least to sit down with Caesar and begin to think about signing contracts. That committee was made up of five bishops. I acted as the staff man. Later on, Bishop Mahoney, or Father Mahoney, then came in as second staff man and secretary of the committee. The chairman of the committee was Bishop Donnelly of Connecticut. The reason he was chosen is that he had more experience than any bishop in the country before or since in the labor field. He had been the director of the State Mediation Board in Connecticut for 20 years. He had been involved in hundreds and hundreds of strike situations. He had professional expertise. The other bishops, two were from California. One was from Texas at that time. Later became the Cardinal of Boston, Madero's. He was appointed because of Texas. And the fifth one was a bishop from the East who was the chairman of the committee, or of the department. Mm-hmm. So he was there representing the department. But as it turned out, in effect, it became a one-man committee because of Donnelly's experience. The other bishops met occasionally. We all met once or twice in California with Caesar and went to the Union headquarters and so forth. But the actual day-to-day work was done by one bishop, the chairman, Bishop Donnelly, and myself, and then Bishop Father Mahoney, later Bishop Mahoney. We went to California literally dozens of times. I went more often than the bishop because he was busier than I was. But we met up and down the valleys, all over the state, with growers, with the union, of course. We had many meetings with Caesar and the staff, and tried to play the role of breaking the ice. Caesar was desperate, and he admitted it. He was absolutely desperate. He couldn't get a contract. Nobody would sit down and get this union, but where does he go with it? Nobody would deal with it. So we met with growers all over the state, trying to soften them up, get them to at least sit down with Caesar and consider it. Well, to make a long story short, after a lot of hard work and endless meetings, finally, to some extent through our intervention, some of the growers agreed to sit down, and we were there, of course, when the first contracts were signed. And that's what Caesar was desperately looking for. That's what he wanted from the committee at that time. The boycott wasn't the big issue then. The issue was, is there any way that anybody can help me get these people to sit down and begin to negotiate? Well, then they got the first contracts, which were signed in the Chancery office down in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And then from then on, nature took its course and Caesar got a lot of other contracts. Then later on, when the boycott became an issue, the bishops didn't act until the Teamsters moved in. And it was clear that the Teamsters intended, from everything you could observe, the Teamsters intended to displace the farm workers, and they would take over in a kind of a sweetheart deal. On the basis of that intervention by the Teamsters, then, I was able then to get the bishops to consider the boycott. I said, we can't. I knew normally they would not support a boycott. This is not the way the conference operates, and it never has, and I think seldom will in the future take a specific boycott and support it. But they did in this case because I was able to convince them, and Bishop Donnelly and others, that this was a desperate situation. This fledgling union was just getting off the ground, and along comes this big union to break them and take over. So on that basis, they supported the boycott. So it was a series of steps, but in my opinion, the primary function that the committee performed was not the one that got the publicity of supporting the boycott, but it was the work they did as a mediating group through a long, long process of endless meetings with the growers and with Caesar, trying to break the ice so that he could get some contracts, because they were in the position then of having a union with no place to go. And that part of it was less sensational, less dramatic, but I think it was the important breakthrough for Caesar. Mm-hmm. The boycott became an issue later in the conference. That was the first step was the mediating role, mm-hmm. Putting pressure on the growers to see if we could get some action. And So that's about what, that was the, really the role of the National Conference. Now there were all kinds of other people around the country giving support in one way or another, either supporting the boycott or sending people out there to help or contributing money. So we had no control over that. That was none of our business. They, to some extent, it was prompted by the support of the bishops. That gave it a certain credibility, certain respectability. In my own view, the important work the committee did was in that initial stage of when there was nobody else around at that time who was in quite the same position as the Bishops' Committee was to kind of get a breakthrough. And Father Mahoney, Bishop Mahoney, would have the record, I think, of all of those meetings. Mm-hmm. Every time we had a meeting in California with the growers, he would keep meticulous notes on it. And so he's got a fairly well-documented story of that phase of the intervention at the national level.
Those first contracts you mentioned, was that Steinberg. And K.K. Larson?
Yeah.
The Valley? Okay.
Yeah. Just two or three of them, I think, on our stage. But if Caesar at that time made no bones, but that was his desperate concern. Mm-hmm. He just could not get a contract. And we managed, for one way or another, to soften them up enough since a few of them began to say, all right, we'll sit down.
Why did they? Why were they willing to do that for the Bishops Committee?
Well, I don't know whether they did it for the Bishops Committee, but I couldn't. There's no way that I could measure what cause and effect was. But I think one of the things that that might have prompted them was they felt that here was a mediating body which could at least be an observer at the negotiation. We sat in on most of the negotiations. They were very distrustful of the farm workers, not only on ideological grounds, but they didn't know what these people were going to demand of them. Mm-hmm. And they wanted observers always at the meetings. We were not interested in being observers. We didn't, it was none of our business to get involved in the contracts, but Caesar agreed, and I think also welcomed observers. From his point of view, we could see whether they were cheating or mm-hmm. being intransigent. The growers, I think, felt that if there was an outside observer team there of a few people, this might keep the farm workers from being completely irresponsible, etc. So the two had a joint interest in having observers present. So during most of the early contract negotiations, we were always present. Mm-hmm. At great discomfort, I can tell you, just I wasted days and days and days of sitting there listening to Dolores fight these people to the last inch, you know. But we just sat there. Mm-hmm. We played no role. Then at various stages, we did play a specific role. For example, when Interharvest decided to settle. Well, let me go backstage. Our first intervention role at the request of the parties was when the Teamsters signed their first agreement, jurisdictional agreement, mm-hmm. when they were going to get out of the field and give it back to Caesar. As you know, that didn't work out. It
yes.
didn't pan out. But we were present in the hotel when that agreement was written, Mahoney and I. And for the next 10 days, I stayed on as a kind of an observer to see how this, they gave them a 10-day period of grace to get the Teamsters out. The agreement said, we will get out, but you got to give us time. They agreed on 10 days. So I went to the meetings with the Teamsters and the growers in which they explained this agreement. It didn't work out. We played that kind of a role. Then, immediately after the Teamsters agreement, the day it was announced, Interharvest came to us and said, we want to settle. We would like to sit down and start negotiating. But they had a lot of problems to get, hurdles to get over with. Their main concern was that as a national or international firm, they didn't feel that they could come into California as carpetbaggers without some kind of an election. They were ready to settle. They didn't care what kind of an election it was. They just had, they had to be able to say that this is the wish of the workers. Mm-hmm. Well, Dolores was very adamant. She said they're not going to get an election. We've got the workers, and they know it, So we're not going to give them election. Well, I said, that's entirely up to you, Dolores. I said, then you're not going to get a contract. So you make the decision. I'm only here as a messenger boy. Well, tempers cooled, and they finally agreed then to a card check. Mm-hmm. And I spent all night, literally all night, alone doing the card check. Because she wouldn't trust anybody from the company to be in the room. The company had two experienced secretaries who could have done it in 2 hours, probably. But she wouldn't allow that. So I sat there all night long going through the card check. Now, I can tell you this, but you dare not publish it or dare not tell it to anybody. Okay. They didn't have the cards. I finagled it. Dolores said, we've got 90% of the work. She didn't have them. She didn't have enough to win. Okay. She doesn't know this to this day. I had no qualms of conscience about it because I knew the company wanted to settle. They didn't care what kind of account you had or what kind of an election. They had to be able to say that we're doing this because our workers have voted either through a card check or through an election, and we're going to settle with them. Mm-hmm. Well, after 12 hours of work all night long, I discovered that Dolores didn't have the cards. I merely then wrote a letter to both parties, a one or two sentence letter, saying, having checked the cards, etc., etc., I hereby certify that the UFW has the majority of votes. And Dolores asked me then, semi-publicly, what was the actual count? Oh, I said, Dolores, I think in my role I better just keep that to myself. I'm not going to tell either party what the count was. There's no point in it. But she doesn't know that, so please don't ever tell her.
Okay.
So they didn't have the votes. But in any event, I certified it, and then they settled. It took them a week or two, but they negotiated and they settled. We played that kind of a role occasionally, more or less behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. But other than that, the conference as such didn't do much except support the boycott, have this committee, which was available on 5 minutes' call to go to California, if they wanted them to sit in on negotiations or wanted them to meet with a group of growers, and we did that over and over and over again. I was out there, I don't know how many times, maybe 50 times during that period. But that was a kind of a quiet role. That wasn't a big sensational public role. The boycott then was a public thing. They supported the boycott. And I assume that made it easier for them then to get support for the boycott from other groups. Other Catholic groups saying, well, since the bishops have done this, there's no reason why we shouldn't do it. So they looked to the conference for that leadership.
No, I don't have the date of when the bishops' committee supported that. Do you know that date?
No, I don't have the
date. But Bishop Mahoney would probably know.
If anybody has, he has the most complete file.
Okay.
I never kept notes on anything. I never have in my life, but he always did. He kept very precise notes on every meeting we ever had. But I didn't have time for that sort of thing.
Yes.
So whatever files. I had files, but I don't know where they are now, but not that kind of files.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't keep records. But see, you had a two-phase in intervention or involvement of the conference. The one was the committee doing this spade work, mm-hmm. which was slow and tedious. Very little publicity about it because in the nature of things, publicity would not have helped.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mediating role. And then the other one was the official action of the whole body of bishops in supporting the boycott. The body of bishops were not involved at all in what we were doing. That was delegated to a committee, and the committee did the work. And for all practical purposes, the committee from day to day was a one-man committee because you couldn't be having five bishops traipsing around California, but you had an experienced bishop who had great expertise in this field and who had the respect of Caesar. Caesar liked him very much, and he was able to deal with the growers and build up a certain confidence. And that was one role. The other role, all of the bishops participated in the second role because they had a vote on this boycott.
Mm-hmm.
But that was their only involvement as a body of bishops.
Mm-hmm.
The process in any organization is committee work. And they gave this over to a committee to represent them. And the committee then did whatever it wanted. It was free to make its own decisions. But I don't have any recollection of dates. I couldn't tell you exactly what dates any of these things happened. Some of it has been written up. in Jacques Levy's book, I think Taylor's book. There are a number of books which give a general...
I have to go back to those, and I'll look for those dates.
Levy might have it. I forget. It's been so long since I've read any of those books, but I know that two or three or more of them have references to the work of the committee and a fairly adequate summary of the work. Some of them also have references to MacDonald and McCulloch. They were the two key men, in a sense. I don't think Caesar, on his own, at that time, was thinking at all in terms of a union. He knew nothing about Catholic social teaching, or he was just making his way as a very young man in San Jose. And MacDonald got him involved in reading some of the social encyclicals, and they began to talk about trade unionism, and one thing led to another. But their work has been almost forgotten because they're out of the field now. They're not involved anymore. But they were the from the Catholic side, they were the original contact with Caesar.
I'm very glad to know that. And I'm going up to Santa Barbara next week, and I'll try to arrange to see also Father Vizard.
Yeah, Vizard has had terribly bad health all his life, but in the last 10 years, I think it's been worse. And my impression is that he's probably in their retirement section of the Santa Clara University. The last I heard, he was. He's had back operations, eye operations, and God knows what. And I just haven't heard his name mentioned in a long time, but I'm sure he's still living. He would have a lot of memories of the movement, not in connection with the conference. This was his own work out there. At that time, I believe, he was representing the National Catholic Rural Life Conference. And so he spent a lot of, well, he's a native of California anyhow, he spent a lot of time out there before the Bishops' Conference got involved. See, our problem was that, among other problems, we were 3,000 miles away from that scene. We knew a little about it, as everybody did, reading about it, but it wasn't something that we observed all the time. And when the Bishops' Committee got involved, then, of course, we were out there all the time. I spent more time in California than I did here for a year or two, in and out, you know, all the time, representing the committees, usually with Bishop Donnelly, sometimes alone. And most of the time, Bishop Mahoney was with us. He was invaluable because he was a Californian who knew the geography, who knew the people, who knew how to get to places. And
He was in Fresno at the time, wasn't he?
He was in Fresno then. He was a priest. He wasn't a bishop then. But he was able to get free, and he'd drive us all over the state. We were all up and down the state all the time, every valley. But as I say, that was the kind of work which was, I think, from my point of view, more important than supporting the boycott. Because it did something that, for a variety of reasons at that particular time, nobody else was able to do. Not because we were any smarter than anybody else, but here was a group that came in that had enough credibility that we could get both sides to talk to us. And I think it would be fair to say that, to some extent at least, it was the intervention of the Bishops' Committee that made it possible in the early stages to get some contracts. I don't think it would have any effect today at all. That was a different period. But when everybody was flying blind and had no experience at all in this field, including Caesar.
Yes. You know, another aspect that I'm very interested in, it would seem as though the within the farm workers' movement, in a commitment to service, that a great deal happened in ecumenical relations in that setting. For instance, Leroy Chatfield, coming to the movement first as a Christian brother, he told me that Jim Drake was the first Protestant clergyman he'd ever met. And some of the Protestants have given me the same kind of reports. This was the first actual contact that many had ever had with Catholic religious.
I'm sure that's true. That kind of built into the situation. They began to meet one another on a common cause. I'm sure that's true. Phase of the religious problem is worth not serious analysis, but mere mention. and I think Chris knows this, I always took a different position with regard to the role of the church than I think Chris did, in this sense, that I always felt the church would be in a better position, or at least I, as a church representative, would be in a better position if I could keep a reasonable distance from the union, in the sense of maintaining my own integrity. I always had the fear that Chris's movement, at least for a time, became so identified in the public mind with being Caesar's errand boys, mm-hmm. that they didn't have the credibility that we were able to maintain, at least during that early period. Everybody knew we were for the union. We never, there was never any secret of that. Mm-hmm. And we told the growers knew exactly where we stood and what our purpose was, and that was to get that union on its way and to get some contracts. But I don't think they ever felt that we were under Caesar's control, as it were, that we were free, if we wanted to criticize Caesar. Mm-hmm. And at times we did, not publicly, but at times we did privately. And I always felt that it was, at least in our case, it was necessary to keep a certain distance so that we would not be thought of as being co-opted by the movement, mm-hmm. and merely echoing what Caesar wanted done. I can give you one example. This is not for your notes, please, of what I mean by that. When the as I indicated earlier, and as you know, when they signed the agreement, they said, you've got to give us 10 days. So during that 10 days, the Teamsters, theoretically, we're supposed to go to the growers and say, look, it's all over. We're getting out. And, you know, it's up to you. You make your decision, but obviously you're going to sign with Caesar. But we're getting out. Mm-hmm. But they needed that 10-day period, they said. They divided into 6 and 4. At the end of 6 days, if they hadn't been able to do it in 6 days, I, as the observer, had the right to say they had another 4 days to complete the 10. Mm-hmm. I gave them the other 4 days. I was in my hotel room, a motel room in Salinas, reading. I spent more time in Salinas motels than and knock on the door. And here's Dolores with, I guess, Jerry Cohen, I suppose. What's his name, the organizer?
Marshall Gans.
Marshall Gans, 3 or 4 of them, 5 maybe. And Dolores was breathing fire. I could see as soon as she came in there was something bothering her. So to make a long story short, they sat on the floor wherever they could sit, and I said, what's your problem? What occasions this wonderful visit in the middle of the night when I'm reading an interesting book? Well, Caesar is very unhappy with you. Oh, I said, is that so? About what? Because you gave the Teamsters another 4 days. Oh, I said, yes, of course I did. I said, that was in the agreement. I had the authority to give them the 4 days, and I figured 4 more days might work out, it may not. So I gave them the 4 days. Well, they said, Caesar is very unhappy with you. Well, at that time, Caesar was on some kind of a hunger strike, and he was hidden away in some Franciscan monastery. And I said, well, you have one great advantage over me. That's obvious, because I don't even know where Caesar is. I'm out here trying to help him. I wouldn't know how to get him on the phone now. I wouldn't know how to send him smoke signals. And I said, I find this rather odd that he would ask me to come all the way out from California, and then he goes into hiding, and then he sends you people here as messengers. But I said, all I can tell you is I've got news for you. I don't work for Caesar. You do, and if that's a problem for you, well, that's your problem. But I said, I work for the National Conference of Bishops, and I'm here as trying to help Caesar. At his request, I'm acting as this observer of monitoring this agreement. The agreement was that I had the authority to give them another 4 days. I gave it to them. Now, I said, if Caesar doesn't like that, please get in touch with him, because you know how to do it and I don't. Get in touch with him and tell him to convey that message to me. I have a million things to do back in Washington. I will catch the first plane out of San Francisco tomorrow, and I'll go home and take care of my work. And I will say nothing to anybody unless I get a request or an inquiry from a newspaper man. And then I will say, I left because my usefulness was exhausted, because Caesar went back on his agreement. The agreement was I had the authority to give him 4 days, and I gave it to them. Well, then they cooled off. And the next night, then they had a rally, and I had to go to the rally, and they said that the workers were up in arms about that, and I said, well, that's your communication problem, not mine, really. You made the agreement, and if you can't communicate that with your members, well, you've got a problem, but it isn't a problem that I can solve. But I said, I'll help you. So I had to go to this rally and get up in the back of a truck and explain why I gave them the 4 days. Well, as it turned out, it was purely an academic issue because the thing fell through anyhow. Nothing ever came of the agreement. But that's what I mean by keeping the independence. There was no way that I was going to deny that 4 days if I thought it was the right thing to do just because Caesar didn't want it done. Mm-hmm. I made the judgment on my own, which I was authorized to do, and I did it, and that was it. So I wanted to maintain that kind of independence. I didn't want to be thought of. Our usefulness as a committee would have been completely destroyed, and our usefulness with the Teamsters would have been completely destroyed if they thought that I was merely a messenger boy for Caesar, if they couldn't trust me to make my own judgments. Mm-hmm. So I made the judgment, and that was it. Now, that's a very small little incident, mm-hmm. but it illustrates why I felt that I always got along beautifully with Caesar, never any problems at all, and I was very supportive of him, and he knew that. But I think he also knew that at a certain point, if I thought he was wrong, I'd tell him in private. One of the services we performed for the union, I think, and for the growers during this mediating process was that privately we were able to tell them, look, you're wasting your time on this issue. You're never going to get it. So go back to your caucus and decide what's realistic. But this one we can tell you from our observation, you're never going to get. And we can tell the same thing to the growers. Say, if you think that Caesar's ever going to give up this demand, you're crazy. Now, if you want a settlement, you've got to decide how you compromise it. But we can tell you from the basis of our own experience that on that issue, Caesar is not going to budge. We never got involved in the negotiations, but we were able to convey that kind of information to break the deadlock. And we could not have done that unless both parties trusted us. Now, the growers had very little reason to trust us because they knew we were out there too. We always made it very plain that we believed in unions, our whole tradition was in favor of unions, that we wanted to see the farm workers organized, but we were there to help them. If they were interested in negotiating, we were there to try to help them. So that's the role we played back and forth up to.
Jerry Cohen told me that it was a really important role, and he has pleasant memories of that, and he was acting out for me, you and Donnelly coming in and laying down the law for them.
Well, occasionally we do. Jerry's memories have mellowed over the years. He wasn't
I'm sure.
He wasn't so happy at the time. He detailed summary of the way we operated in that particular phase of the work. And as I say, other people would differ. People have different norms by which they judge the involvement of the church. But my own impression is that was the most distinctive role that the national office played. Because at that time, for whatever reason, nobody else was able to play it.
Yes.
And they came in at just the right time. I'm not sure the same thing could be done again in another state or at another time. The time was ripe for it then. Mm-hmm. That was the way it went.
Among Protestants, there has been a historic difficulty for laity to feel okay about bringing religion into a secular setting, like a labor struggle.
Yeah.
Has that been true with Catholics, or have the Catholics generally been more enlightened than that?
Well, I wouldn't use the word enlightened because that's disparaging of the other point of view. I think it's a different, something of a different theological tradition perhaps, but I think a different experience. Catholics in the United States up until a generation ago were a working class church. Protestantism was not in general, that is mainline Protestantism. You had many smaller groups in the South that were exclusively workers, mm-hmm. but the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, the Lutherans, the Methodists were not considered in the same sense that the Catholic community was of an immigrant working class church. You add to that we had a long tradition in our teaching favoring trade unionism, and the two combined made it, not inevitable, but made it natural. mm-hmm. that a certain number of priests, not all, but a certain number of priests would feel quite at home in working in the labor field. And in the long before Caesar came along, in the 30s and the 40s, in the industrial area, the churches were deeply involved in the labor thing, with labor schools, labor institutes, supporting the organization of industrial workers, etc., etc. Much of that has died out now. Mm-hmm. But when the CIO was getting started in that period, when I first came to Washington, and for some 10, 15 years after that, there were priests all over the country who were involved in the labor field, but in the industrial areas. Mm-hmm. There was no theoretical problem of that kind at all. Once they appointed this bishop's committee, it was the most natural thing in the world for them to get involved. And particularly in the case of Bishop Donnelly, who had spent 20 years at this. He had started out as a young priest in Connecticut in the days when the CIO was getting started. As a young priest, he had labor schools, labor institutes all over the state, and was very active in supporting the union movement. But it was always in the industrial area. He didn't know anything about the farm area. But when he was appointed chairman, he brought to that work a certain experience and talents that he had developed over the years. So he was a natural for it. I can tell you off the record, although this is very important, that if he had not been the chairman, it's very unlikely the committee would have succeeded. Because you just can't take any bishop out of a barrel and say, I'm going to make you chairman of a committee on farming. He wouldn't know what to do. He wouldn't know where to begin.
Yes.
So it was providential, extremely providential, that Donnelly was the appointed chairman, and providential in that Donnelly and I were old friends. I had known him long before this. I'd known him all my priesthood, and had worked with him when he was in Connecticut. So we were we could communicate by sign language almost. We knew one another perfectly well, and he was. From my point of view as a staff man, he was the perfect chairman to work for because he knew what he was doing, and I could call him on the phone and in 2 minutes take care of something that would take 2 weeks if you had a chairman who didn't know the field. So it made a very providential working team, and we were on the phone every day for that period, and frequently we were together in California. It was not easy for him because he was a bishop and busy. He had a lot of work to do at home. And he was, even though he was very experienced, he wasn't particularly experienced in the chaotic procedures of the farm workers. He was used to dealing with the more orderly. Mm-hmm. So it took a little patience on his part to find that they didn't show up at meetings on time, that sort of thing, you know, mm-hmm. or when they got there was a lot of confusion, but he was good about it. Another man who was very helpful to Caesar, of course, to the union, but also to the committee, and we worked very closely with him, was Bill Kircher. Mm-hmm. Kircher had been out there, in and out of California long before we got there, representing the AFL-CIO, and he had a very fine working relationship with Caesar. Caesar trusted him, and he was very helpful to him. So when the Bishop's Committee was established, we worked very closely with Kircher to get his expertise, consulted with him often, and he was a strong supporter of the...
Where is Bill now?
Bill's in bad health, he's retired. He is just arriving back in Cincinnati today. I think he's been down in Florida recuperating from a stroke, and he's finished for active work. It's killing him, the frustration of not being able to be active is just tearing him apart, but he's had 2 strokes and I don't think he may live a while, but he won't never be active again.
Has it affected his speech?
It did initially, but not now. But it slowed him down just mm-hmm. for a while his speech was affected.
I wanted to ask you about, I've been thinking about whether I might meet
him. Oh, he'd
him.
Be delighted to see you. He'd be overjoyed that anybody was interested in him, you know, mm-hmm. give him a chance to get back into the, from a distance at least, into the swing of things. Mm-hmm. I think he, off the record, he has always, not always, but at times I think he's felt that the farm workers didn't appreciate him, and now in his illness, that's aggravated, I suppppose, because very often people who have a stroke become a little sensitive. Mm-hmm. discombobulated. So he blows a little hot and cold on that. He's, I think, quite disappointed, but this is not for repetition. Mm-hmm. He's quite disappointed, I think, that had some of the mishaps they've had in the union. He was very close to Jerry, of course, mm-hmm. and he felt very badly about that mix-up when Jerry left. He was very close to Gilbert, mm-hmm. particularly, and Gilbert, as you know, is quite bitter now. Mm-hmm. So Bill's caught in between those two. Mm-hmm. He's very loyal to Caesar, but he's also very loyal to these people, mm-hmm. and he feels very badly that...
It's a great misfortune that we have to feel divided when we like all of these people and they all served so well. Yeah. I think it's so unfortunate.
Well, I was not surprised. I tend to try to be realistic and pragmatic. I was not surprised that Caesar made what I would consider some mistakes, mm-hmm. but some of his followers were, mm-hmm. because they had built up a mythology around him. You mentioned Gene Boyle. I remember being with Gene in the Coachella Valley when a delegation from the National Federation of Priest Councils, he was then working for them, came to California to look at the farm labor situation. And they were out in the field all day, and we ended up in somebody's hotel room to have a drink. About, I guess, six or eight priests there representing the National Office of the Priest Councils. And I said that I thought we ought to take a long-range view of the thing and not be surprised if the union made mistakes. All unions make mistakes. Everybody is human. And I said, I don't think it would be wise to build up a mythology around Caesar as though there's something mystical about him. Mm-hmm. He's a human being, and he has his own weaknesses, and there may be times when we'll disagree with him. Well, Gene became very angry. And he used the line on me which Chris used once or twice. Who are you to be telling poor people what to do? Well, I said, you know, that doesn't impress me in the least. That's not my language. If a poor person makes a mistake, I'm sorry, but it's a mistake, and I'm not about to make my judgments on the issue of whether he's poor or rich or in between. Well, the moral of the story is that Gene now is quite critical, mm-hmm. and to some extent, mild extent, a little disillusioned. Mm-hmm. That's too strong a word, but he's changed his tune. And I told him recently, I said, Gene, one of the fears I've always had about the involvement of church people in the farm labor thing is they're going to mythologize it. Mm-hmm. And then they become disillusioned. A number of church people have become very disillusioned, as you know. Yes. And disillusionment to me is a sign of immaturity. It means that you held up ideals which were never going to be realized.
Yes.
And then when they're not realized... You become hurt. Now, that's what happened, as you know, to a number of the Protestant people on the case of the Philippines fiasco. There's still a great reservoir of disillusionment among many of the Protestants that I meet.
And some Catholics, too. I met with Jack Ahern, and he...
Yeah.
That was really when he stopped helping.
Well, a lot of them did, in a way. I was not disillusioned by it, but I was very frank with Caesar. Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that people do things that I don't agree with, mm-hmm. but I wasn't about to tell him that I agreed with him. Mm-hmm. And when he called that meeting in Delano several years ago, at the request mainly of the Protestant groups who wanted to have a think session with him about this, sort it all out, I think they thought they were going to meet with him in a room of about 15 or 20 people. When we got there, there were 300 or 400 people and pickets outside, and it turned into a fiasco. And Caesar made the mistake of bringing to the platform two Filipinos from the Philippines who were spokesmen for Marcos. And he wanted me to sit on the stage with him. I said, no, I will not. I said, no way, I'm going to sit on the stage and lend my credibility to these two men who are here representing the Marcos point of view. Well, it turned into a terrible fiasco because the anti-Marcos people were in the hall, Caesar's people were in the hall, and you almost needed police protection. It became so wild. But that's what I mean by independence. I stood up on the floor that day and I said, see, I don't agree. I had told Caesar right from the very beginning that I thought that he made a mistake in the Philippines, and I said, that can happen to anybody, but I said, I think you ought to correct it. You ought to find some way of getting off this dime. Mm-hmm. He never did. Never answered my mail, as a matter of fact. Never discussed it with me. Well, that didn't disillusion me. But he knows perfectly why I don't agree with him on it. I never did, and I told him that. So that's another example of why I always felt that it was healthier for me to be very supportive of him, but to be my own man. Mm-hmm. Because once your credibility is lost, it's hard to get back. If people say, well, you're only doing that because Caesar wants you to do it, mm-hmm. No, that won't work.
You've really raised an interesting issue that that perhaps that particular idea that Chris's work was based on of servanthood encouraged people to mythologize not only Caesar but the movement.
Yeah, I don't denigrate it. I can see that there are some people who may feel it's their vocation to put aside everything else and just serve Caesar, mm-hmm. serve the FW. That's one role. Mm-hmm. But it was not a role that I could play. It wasn't a role I was prepared to play. I was able to do things for the Union which I could only have done if I had my own independence. Mm-hmm. One thing that we were able to do, and it's unpublicized and just as well that it is, and it wasn't world-shaking, but I was able to act as an intermediary between Caesar and the rest of the labor movement, mm-hmm. in numerous occasions, which I could not have done unless they knew that I was independent. Mm-hmm. And Caesar had and still has problems with the labor movement. He always will have, because he plays his own game. Caesar is not a team player in the labor movement, and therefore there were times when I was one of the few people who could go to the labor movement and say, look, maybe you don't agree with Caesar on this, but the cause is important and you've got to get behind it. And that was a role that you could only play. It was a role that Chris couldn't have played because they figured, well, he's too tied in with Caesar. Mm-hmm. So I don't denigrate the other. I just really say there are different roles to play.
I can sympathize with you.
But this is, you know, I'm getting way off your theme, but I want to put it in some kind of a setting.
Yes.
Because I think the tendency has been in some of the writing about the farm workers to put it too exclusively in terms of the church and the poor. Mm-hmm. It's a more complicated thing than that, I think. Serving the poor is one thing, but helping to get a union started is another. Mm-hmm. And that was Caesar's big challenge, to get that union going and to get contracts and to get established in the labor movement. I was somewhat influential in getting him a charter, mm-hmm. in the AFL-CIO. And I told him then when he got it, I said, Caesar, now that if you want to be a member of the CIO, AFL-CIO, you have to be an active member. You can't take a charter just to hang it on your wall. Mm-hmm. You have to go to conventions, you have to participate in the conventions, and you have to talk about other issues than the farm labor problem. If you're going to be a charter or a member of a federation, they don't want you up all the time speaking only about your own problems. They want you to be an active member of the whole federation. I don't think Caesar will ever do that very much because he's necessarily preoccupied with his own problems of struggle for existence. But he has lost the support of a fair number of unions by going his own way on political action. Mm-hmm. I went out to Honolulu 4 or 5 years ago to give a speech at the convention of one of the major unions, a big union. And I took advantage of the opportunity to put in a strong plug for the farm workers. After the meeting, one of the regional leaders of this movement from the West Coast came up to me and he said, I've heard you say that before, but he said, you can go back and tell Caesar that if he wants to play ball, he has to play ball. And we have, all the unions in California have agreed on certain political stances they're going to take, mm-hmm. and Caesar goes his own way. That's all right. But he said, then don't come to me looking for money. He was very firm about it. Mm-hmm. And that's been a continuing problem with Caesar. Mm-hmm. That most of the unions today, I think, including those which bankrolled him for a long time, the auto workers and others, I think are rather, they're not against him, but they're rather cool now. Mm-hmm. And I think Caesar's arrived at the stage now where he has to make it on his own. People are not going to eternally hold his hand, you know. Mm-hmm. For a while, the auto workers were putting enormous amounts of money in there every month. Mm-hmm. I don't think they are anymore. They don't have it to begin with now. They got their own problems. But that was one of the great tragedies of the loss of Gilbert Padilla. Gilbert Padilla was the only one I knew in the farm worker movement who had very good relationship with other unions. Mm-hmm. He knew their language. He was able to deal with them. He had an office at the AFL-CIO. They gave him free rental, which put him in touch on a day-to-day basis with the leadership of the movement.
Where was that?
Here in Washington, downtown. Mm-hmm. When he came to Washington as the Washington representative, he had no money, of course, you know, but they gave him an office, and that's where he operated out of. And he got along beautifully with the other unions. And when he left, that didn't help at all. Mm-hmm. Because these people had come to know him and like him. He was different from Caesar in the sense that he could mingle with the other labor leaders and socialize with them and be at home with them, whereas Caesar tends to be so preoccupied with his own problem that he kind of stays on the side at labor conventions and that sort of thing. Gilbert would be around meeting everybody, a different temperament, different mm-hmm. style, but it was a great loss in that sense. Gilbert got along beautifully with the other labor movements and was very helpful to Caesar in that regard.
Had he been a labor man before he got involved with farm workers?
I don't know. He was in Texas for a long time. I don't know what his earlier background was. But I think it was a matter of temperament and style. Mm-hmm. Everybody's different.
Jim Drake talked about the farm workers union as being quite unusual in that Caesar used community organizing tactics, and Jim thought it was probably the only labor union that had been organized using those kinds of tools.
I suppose that's true, more or less true. It may be the only way he could have done it. You know? Mm-hmm. Farm workers are a different breed from auto workers. It's a different context in which to organize. It was one of the things that always made it difficult for the rest of the labor movement to understand him, because it was outside their normal way of doing things. You know? Mm-hmm. They never could decide whether it was a labor movement or a movement. Mm-hmm. And that always, big city boys who grew up in a different environment always found it very difficult to understand that. Now, one of the roles that Bill Kircher played was to interpret the movement to the rest of the labor movement, and I think he did it very effectively. And he was in a high position in the labor movement, one of the ranking staff people in the labor movement. And his help, I think, was extremely, almost indispensable to the workers. But it was very difficult for some of the union people to figure out where Caesar was going, whether he was leading a social movement or whether he was organizing a labor movement. Mm-hmm. And they just couldn't understand this mixture. But Bill could, and did, and he liked Caesar, and Caesar liked him. And Bill had enormous experience in the labor movement, so he was able to act as a kind of a bridge. But it'd be very useful for you to talk to Bill. He's got long memories in this field.
Maybe before I go, you could give me
I think I have his number
here.
He just came back today or tomorrow, possibly, from Florida.
Mm-hmm. Bill is an active Catholic layman, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bill's Catholic.
Was that one of the reasons that he was able to understand the farm worker movement?
Well, not necessarily, because there are a lot of Catholics in the labor movement who didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it was about Bill that he was very attracted to the movement and spent a lot of time out there. Mm-hmm. So much time that it got him into a little trouble occasionally here at the national office. They'd say, well, look, you're supposed to be the director of organization for the whole country, mm-hmm. and when we're looking for you, you're out in California all the time. So there was always a little tension there. But for some reason, Bill would have to explain that himself, of what it was that attracted him to the... And made it possible for him to understand the mentality of the farm workers and the Hispanic religious overtones of the movement, all that. But not just because he was a Catholic, because a lot of Catholics didn't understand it at all. After all, the president of the Teamsters was a Catholic. Mm. He certainly didn't understand them. He's dead now, but he...
But Simmons.
Simmons, yeah. No, Bill brought his own set of qualities to it. Maybe his Catholicism helped him to understand a little better the religious overtones of the movement, but I don't think the Catholicism was the main thing, because there were so many Catholics who didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. Traditional labor leaders who had another way of operating, different from Caesar's. Mm-hmm. But he struck up a good relationship with Caesar, and they got along beautifully. But it's been a tragic experience for Bill because he was so close to the... Yeah, Bill would be very important to talk to. Okay. Because he knows, obviously knows a lot about the farm workers, but he also knows a lot about the church's involvement. He was very helpful to the committee, and we met with him frequently, and he was a good friend of Bishop Donnelly, and a good friend of mine for years before he got in the farm work. Mm-hmm. So he's a good bridge between the two. And it can interpret better than anybody, I think, the labor movement's response to mm-hmm. Caesar.
I wanted to ask your opinion on, as far as just the general way that the labor scene looks to you today in terms of organizing. I'm struggling to understand what is happening now in terms of organizing farm workers. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's understandable apart from the larger picture of the state of the economy.
No, but it's really not. Everything's a ball of wax right now. I think Caesar's faced with terrible difficulties. They all are, of course. They're because of for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. The political climate, the recession, the overseas foreign trade problem, the move to the south, new technology, all kinds of problems. The labor movement is in a very desperate state, I think, and I think that's not going to make Caesar's work any easier. The whole atmosphere is more difficult. So Caesar's got they all have, but he has a union that's just trying to get going. He's got an even more difficult position. I think the biggest problem Caesar has to face is that the mythology is worn off, and that if he were to try to duplicate what he did in the late 60s and early 70s of getting the college kids out, he wouldn't get them. Mm-hmm. They're not there. It's a different atmosphere, and I think he knows that. Mm-hmm. The days when Caesar was on the front page of every Rodegravure magazine and on every television, those are all gone. So that never again, I think, is Caesar going to be the folk hero mm-hmm. that he was in the late 60s and early 70s. So he's faced now with a different set of circumstances. As you know, he's putting a lot of hope in his high-tech boycott. I don't know. I have no way of knowing whether that's going to work or not. That's something new to me. I'm not even sure I understand how it's going to function. But I have the feeling that that boycotts have reached the point of diminishing returns. They're not automatically successful. There are a lot of boycotts.